MacCast, Tuesday, July 17th, 2018. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I am happy to be back here with you after a week of summer vacation. It's that time of year, which is why the MacCast schedule is a little chaotic this month. Sorry for a little bit longer delay than normal between shows, but that's the way it's going to be. And we're also going to get disrupted this week because in just a couple days, I am off to MacStock in Woodstock, Illinois. Great conference if you ever get a chance to go. I know some of you are coming. I'm going to be very happy to see you there. And it is just awesome. You can check it out at macstockexpo.com. As a matter of fact, there are still tickets available. So if you still want to show up and get in, I think the code MACCAST will still get you a discount. I would love to see you there. And we'll talk a little bit more about it at the end of the show. But looking over the show notes, wow, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. Really cool stuff. Some big things happened this week. You probably already know what I'm talking about, but maybe some of you don't. Maybe I will surprise you. Likely not, but we'll see. We've got intrigue in today's show, some espionage going on. What else? Movie stars, a new Max to talk about. Yes, lots of things related to new Max, new updates being rumored, iPhone leaks, all the typical stuff. It's going to be a really good show. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. We got a lot more feedback on app subscriptions. We've been talking about that the last few episodes, and we have some more stuff to talk about. I guess this topic really got you going. A lot of people in the community have things to say, and I want to make sure everybody gets a chance to weigh in on their opinion. And of course, I'll be sharing a heavy dose of my own opinion related to that feedback. And then we have a question about cellular data usage. So it's going to be a little bit lighter on the feedback section because we have so much stuff to talk about in the front of the show, specifically related to the new machines. So I say we get right into it. Kicking things off, I'm not sure if you remember back in April, Apple hired a formal Google executive, John Giandrea, and he was hired to head up Apple's artificial intelligence team. This week, Apple told Apple Insider that in addition to running Apple's machine learning division, the former chief of artificial intelligence and search at Google would now be in charge of the Siri team as well. So they're doing a little, not reorganization, but a little restructuring, I guess. And at the top level, Giandrea is going to be the guy both for artificial intelligence, machine learning, and now Siri. And as a matter of fact, Apple did indeed change the information on their company leadership page this past week, giving him the title of Chief of Machine Learning and AI Strategy. I guess that doesn't really reflect the Siri part of it, but that is a change, and he did show up there. Another change Apple made this week, just as an aside, if you haven't seen it, because it's apparently Emoji Week. They announced kind of the new emoji for, I think, 2019 or 2018 that are going to be coming out. Apple changed all of their executive profile images to Memojis, so that's kind of entertaining. If you haven't checked it out, you can check it out at apple.com/leadership. But back to John Giandrea. So he's going to be heading up both those teams. Something interesting also about his early career. In the early days, Giandrea worked as a senior engineer at a company called General Magic. Those of you who have been around as long as I might know that back in the 90s, General Magic was a spinoff company from Apple that was had a bunch of Apple former developers and engineers. They were going to design a personal communicator, actually came out with one in 1994. I think a little bit after the Newton, Apple is kind of perceived as sort of stealing some of their ideas and rolling those into the Newton. But the company included some awesome Apple engineers, guys like Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson. There were also other notable employees throughout the years, Susan Kare, Tony Fadell, Andy Rubin, Megan Smith, and Kevin Lynch, who is actually Apple's current VP of technology, the guy that oversees Apple Watch, among a few other things. And So there's this great heritage and a lot of Giandrea's experience in machine learning and artificial intelligence started back in the days of General Magic. And so I think he's kind of the perfect guy to run both of these teams. Now, internally, the structures of both teams are going to remain the same. So they're still separate entities within Apple. But now up at the top level, they're both going to be under the watch of Giandrea. And Siri's team was previously overseen by Apple's head of software engineering, Craig Federighi. So I apologize for that. And so I think this is ultimately a good thing. A TechCrunch piece that got into this a little bit more into Giandrea's background pointed out that the goals of the two teams have often sort of shared the same direction, right? And so it kind of makes sense to bring them both under the supervision and leadership of a single person. And this guy seems to be perfect for the job. He was actually responsible for kind of bringing machine learning and artificial intelligence into all aspects of what Google was doing, and Apple wooed him away. Now, of course, one of the concerns for a lot of people is, well, is he going to be on board with Apple's security and privacy? And at the time he was hired, Tim Cook said, absolutely, this guy shares our philosophy about security and privacy. It's mentioned in the article that a lot of the technologies that he's going to be overseeing, it's very important that Apple continues to do and do more things on device, keep customer security and privacy number one. And there's some speculation that that might have been one of the reasons why he wanted to move away from Google, was that he was more in that camp of having this idea about security and privacy being a high priority when it comes to especially machine learning and artificial intelligence. On the Siri side of things, this is sort of exciting because a lot of people, and we've talked about this on the show, there's a lot of critics of Siri, and a lot of people feel like Apple has squandered their lead in personal assistants and with Siri, and they've fallen behind other companies like Google and Amazon. And so the push to have machine learning, AI, security and privacy all come in and be integrated with a lot of things inside Siri. This, I think, is also going to help maybe push things forward faster, right? Having one person who's in charge of all that and knows a little bit about what's going on in both of those divisions and where the crossovers and overlaps are. And more importantly, someone who has a lot of experience in the field working as an engineer and coming up through those ranks, I think that's going to be ultimately very important. So it's kind of very exciting news, this little change. You wouldn't think it would be such a big deal, but I'm looking forward to seeing what happens now with this change in Siri and Apple's artificial intelligence stuff moving forward. They've been doing a great job at it so far, and I think it's only going to get better. Another thing Apple talked about a while back was about how serious it was getting about stopping leaks inside the company. A long time ago, Tim Cook said they're doubling down on security, and then we got some reports that Apple's actually been, you know, working, and some employees have on that, and some employees have actually gone to prison over these things. Well, this week, a little incident popped up. Federal authorities arrested a former Apple employee, Zhao Lang Zhang, at the San Jose International Airport. He is being accused of planning to take Apple trade secrets to a startup company called X Motors in China. That's a company focused on electric vehicle and autonomous vehicle technology. Now, Zhang was previously a hardware engineer working on the team at Apple that was doing their ultra secretive autonomous vehicle project. And while there, he had access to a lot of confidential internal databases. As a matter of fact, the report claims that he had broad access to those things. Most recently, he had been on paternity leave from Apple. He took that in April, and then when he returned, he informed the company that he was going to be leaving Apple to take care of his ill mother in China. And I think he also mentioned that he was going to be working for X Motors. He actually left the company on May 5th and had to turn in all his Apple devices. That was when the security team did an analysis and noticed that he had had a dramatic increase of download activity of information from Apple's servers that included confidential files right before he gave his notice. And I guess that's sort of what tipped them off. When he was pulled in and questioned by Apple's security team, he admitted to a number of things. He admitted to Apple that he had airdropped information from his devices to his wife's personal laptop. And he also agreed to let the team examine that laptop, and they claimed that about 60% of the data they found on there was highly problematic. Now, according to the allegations, some of the stuff he reportedly took includes engineering schematics, technical reference materials, and technical reports. He also admitted to Apple that he had removed, while on maternity leave, he had gone in, they had caught him on the video cameras going into Apple's labs, something that was he was not supposed to do. He originally denied that, but then later admitted to Apple's security team that, yes, he went in there and he removed two circuit boards and a Linux server from an Apple hardware lab. So this case is not looking very good for this guy. Now, an Apple spokesman, Tom Neumeyer, said, quote, "Apple takes confidentiality and the protection of our internal intellectual property very seriously. We're working with authorities on this matter, and we will do everything possible to make sure this individual and other individuals involved are held accountable for their actions." Now, Zhang recently pleaded not guilty to the charges and has retained his own lawyer to represent him in the case. If found guilty, he could face up to 10 years in prison and fines of $250,000. So, again, Apple taking this stuff very seriously, and this is just another point of evidence that they plan on doing that and will continue to do so. You guys know who Jason Momoa is? You might know him from his role as Drogo in Game of Thrones if you're a Game of Thrones fan, or more recently as Aquaman in the Justice League. He's actually going to be getting his own movie coming soon. Well, now we have reports that he will reportedly star in Apple's upcoming futuristic drama series called C. He's supposedly taken a role as Baba Voss, who is described as a fearless warrior leader and guardian. The series is being called an epic world-building drama set in the future. That's about all we know about it. We also know that it's supposedly been ordered for an 8-episode run. It's going to be directed by Francis Lawrence, who is known for The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, and Mockingjay, and is being written by Stephen Knight, who is the creator of Peaky Blinders and who will also serve as executive producer on the series. So Apple has, you know, again, been really ramping up, I think, the star power and the caliber of talent in their upcoming TV series. And this is just another example of that. And another reason why I'm super excited about what Apple is doing. They seem to have pulled together just really top talent inside Hollywood. In addition to the report about Jason Momoa joining this series this week, there have also been reports that Letter has been signed on to direct the morning show drama series that's going to star Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. That's another show that Apple had lined up. And all in all, I think at last count, Apple has just over 20 original series or shows that are in development. And we know that they planned on in 2018 spending about $1 billion to produce all of them. Apple's expected to roll out the shows starting sometime in 2019, but we really still don't know quite how they plan to do it. I think last episode we talked about some recent rumors that they may do a bundled plan with Apple Music, iCloud, the new video service, and maybe Texture, their magazine subscription service. and new service, and they likely also plan to offer each service separately. But I really like the idea of a total bundled option, much in the way that Amazon does with Amazon Prime. I think that would be probably the best value, especially for a lot of us like myself who are already iCloud and Apple Music subscribers. So I hope they go that route. I'm hoping it's somewhere in the $20, $25 range for all those services, but we're going to have to wait and see. Luckily, not too much longer. We should find out sometime in 2019. New MacBook Pros? What? You say? Yes, and a big surprise. And of course, while I was on vacation, so I couldn't follow it too closely, Apple magically rolled out an all-new, or a couple of all-new MacBook Pro models this week, both updates to both the 13-inch and the 15-inch models. The updates to the 13 and 15-inch models include new 8th generation Intel processors and DDR4 RAM, which means that gets us past the 16 gigabyte RAM limit, because Apple was using the LP, low power DDR3 RAM in the past, and Intel still hasn't put out processors that support the low power DDR4 RAM. So Apple going with that processor, much to the delight and joy of many pro users. And now you might worry a little bit about battery, but we'll talk about that in a second. You can now get the machines with up to 6 cores on the 15-inch models and 4 cores on the 13-inch models, so quite a performance boost. The processor configurations, of course, vary by model, but at the top end, Apple is now offering an Intel 6-core i9 processor running at 2.9 gigahertz with a turbo boost up to 4.8 gigahertz. So these things are screaming. On the graphics sides, there's improvements there as well. Of course, the 13-inch models come with Intel Iris Plus graphics, and the 15-inch models support Intel UHD graphics with discrete Radeon Pro options. The 555X or the 560X GPUs, depending upon your configuration. They also doubled the max storage capacity on each model. The 13-inch now can be configured up to 2 terabytes of SSD storage or 4 terabytes of SSD storage in the 15-inch models. Of course, one of the big questions was, did Apple redesign the keyboard? Are we going to have a rollback to the old design? What's going on there? Well, Apple stuck with the butterfly keyboard design, although they did say they made some improvements, claiming they made it quieter. And all of the current models still have the touch bar option as well. The new machines come with an Apple T2 chip to handle security and things like Hey Siri, and offer True Tone displays for not just the internal display, but also the touch bar. So these are the first models to feature the True Tone technology. And as a matter of fact, the True Tone options also extend out to the LG ultrafine 4K and 5K displays, as well as Apple's 2011 Thunderbolt display when it's connected to the MacBook Pro using Apple's Thunderbolt 3 to Thunderbolt 2 adapter. And once you connect any one of those displays, there's actually a checkbox that appears in the display settings to be able to control in the system preferences in Hi Siri to be able to control turning on or off the True Tone functionality for the external displays. Back to the processor side of things, Apple says that the new machines are up to 70% faster, and recent Geekbench tests on the new 15-inch model show about a 15 to 19% increase in single-core performance and about a 40 to 46% increase in multi-core performance. On the 13-inch models, you get between a 3 to 11% increase in single-core performance and a whopping 81 to 86% increase in multi-core performance. Again, that's according to Geekbench tests. As far as everything else, the design, the battery life, the ports, and weight of the machines all remain about the same. The machines do actually have larger batteries with more cells. But the battery life remains the same, and that's likely due to the fact that you've got faster processors in there that are a little bit more power hungry, but more likely that the DDR4 RAM has higher power requirements, of course, than the low power DDR RAM they were using before. And so that's probably what's taking up that extra battery. We'll have to wait and see reports of, you know, real world performance of these batteries. In the back of my mind, I have this niggling suspicion that we are going to hear complaints from people about the battery life. And that was one of the concerns that Apple had the last time they updated the MacBook Pro models, and why they didn't go with DDR4 RAM at that point. And many people were disappointed because that did limit it to the 16 gigabyte RAM, you know, max RAM options. So now we're past that, but I have a feeling, you know, the trade-off is going to be a little bit painful, at least until Intel can bring out newer processors that support the low-power DDR4 RAM. As far as pricing goes, that also remains remains the same, at least at the starting level. $1,799 USD is the starting price point for a new 13-inch MacBook Pro model, and $2,399 is the starting price point for the 15-inch MacBook Pro. At the top end, though, wow, you can really max this thing out. That top level 15-inch configuration with that core, with that i9 6-core 2.9 gigahertz processor, 32 gigabytes of RAM, and a 4 terabyte SSD, that's going to set you back about $6,700, $6,699 to be exact. So, you know, you can get all the performance you want and in your portable MacBook Pros now. And I just think these updates are absolutely amazing. I think they're fabulous. I think they're going to make a lot of pros very, very happy. They're also going to make a lot of pros a lot poorer. But I think, you know, having these kinds of screaming machines, it's a well-deserved update for the MacBook Pro line. Now, let's talk about that controversial redesigned keyboard. Apple told The Verge specifically that the keyboard was not redesigned to deal with the sticking or non-functional key issues that have plagued some users of the 2017 and 2016 models. Apple continues to claim that that issue only affects a, quote, tiny, tiny fraction of its user base. I think there's some of you out there who would tend to disagree with that. I've heard from many vocal people, both in the MacCast community and, of course, also in the larger Apple community, that this is more of a systemic problem than Apple has let on. And so that has led to a lot of conspiracy theories, and those are not being helped by the iFixit teardown, which revealed that there was and is a thin silicone barrier around each of the butterfly key mechanisms. So there's a silicone basically seal around each key. Now, it could be there just for noise reduction, and that seems to be Apple's point of view on it. That's the line that they're taking. But as iFixit points out, and just to add to the conspiracy, it closely matches a patent that Apple has for a guard structure designed to keep direct contaminants away from the movement mechanisms in the butterfly keyboard design. So it's there. There's a protective layer. It does seem like it would also function, even if it is just for noise reduction, it could also function to keep dust and bits and particles out from under those keys. And that is what people are saying is causing the sticking and non-functional key problem. So, you know, who knows? That does bring up the question, because Apple does have their replacement program for the older models, the 2016 and 2017 models. Are they going to get that new design with that new silicone membrane? Apple has said no, that's not going to happen. And it's likely because the entire units are part of the upper case design. So that's been the case for the 2016 and 2017 models and continues to be the case for the 2018 model. So where the keyboard sits, it's all part of one component. And that component has been slightly redesigned in the 2018 model to fit the new larger battery arrangement and to shed some weight to compensate for those batteries and keep the overall weight of the new MacBook Pros the same. So they're not going to be able to swap those out, much to the chagrin, I think, of some 2016-2017 MacBook Pro owners who have suffered from the keyboard problems. Something else slightly related to repairs, if you do get one of the new 2018 MacBook Pros, it looks like replacement parts aren't going to be around or available until September. That means that if you do have to send your machine in for any kind of repair or issue, it's likely that you're just going to get a full replacement of your machine because that's all Apple's going to have the ability to do. But these machines, I think, are still very exciting. In addition to the MacBook Pro announcement, there was also a new Blackmagic external GPU that was announced. It was co-developed with Apple. It brings out-of-the-box compatibility with LG's ultra-fine 5K display, so you can plug that 5K display directly into the eGPU and drive it from that. It's designed to be kind of a plug-and-play device. It comes with a Radeon Pro 850 graphics card with 8 gigabytes of memory pre-built into it. It's unclear if you'd even be able to swap it out, so it's kind of just plop it down, plug it in. It's also meant to be super quiet, as low as 18 decibels, and seems to be targeted at the audio and video production studios that also use DaVinci's non-linear editor software like DaVinci Resolve. The price of the Blackmagic eGPU is $699 US, and that, of course, does include that Radeon Pro graphics card. So a really nice new GPU option to go along with that shiny new MacBook Pro. Of course, it's going to drive the price up a little bit. And then finally, some folks are upset because along with this announcement, Apple also did stop selling the 2015 MacBook Pro model. Now, that was the last one you could get with the old non-butterfly keyboard and also the last one that featured the legacy ports, you know, USB 3 ports, display port connectors, Thunderbolt 2, and also the SD card slot. So that was a very popular model. A lot of people who were not happy about the redesigned Apple keyboard have been opting for that model. And so they're a little bit upset and got a little bit vocal this week. And I want to take an aside. You know, normally I would save this for the feedback portion of the show, but I want to talk about some of the community anger that has come out about Apple discontinuing the MacBook Pro model. I think some of it starts with Marco Arment, who has been very vocal about the fact that, you know, he feels the design of the new MacBook Pro keyboard is so divisive that it's bad enough that Apple should abandon it and roll back to the old design, which, you know, everybody, quote unquote, was okay with. Some people even argue that people were fully happy with that and Apple did not need to redesign the keyboard. And I've also heard similar sentiments from members of the Mac Gas community. And look, I totally get it. As a matter of fact, a listener recently wrote me and said, quote, I feel that Apple is making a mistake by no longer selling this machine, referring to the 2015 MacBook Pro design, and is demonstrating tone deafness to the preferences of many people such as myself. He had bought a 2015-inch MacBook Pro, which he absolutely loves. I have a 2015 MacBook Pro, and it's an awesome machine. It's an awesome design, still really relevant. And so it feels like, you know, Apple should continue to sell this model as an option to a lot of people. And I get that. Believe me, I totally understand it, and I get where people are coming from. My question back, though, is anyone really not going to buy a new MacBook Pro because they hate the keyboard design that much? Because that's effectively what's being levied, right? It's like, this is so bad that there's people in the community that will just refuse to buy one. And I'm not so convinced on that, and I don't think there's evidence to support that. As a matter of fact, Apple Insider has been told that the 2016 MacBook Pro outsold the 2015 models dramatically, with one person that they sourced claiming the ratio was something like 48 to 1. So for every one 2015 model, Apple was selling 48 2016 MacBook Pro models. So customers coming into an Apple retail store seem to be obviously opting for the newer model, not the older model, despite all of the press and media about the keyboard design issues. And with data like that, if that turns out to be accurate, again, this is just them polling, you know, Apple retail stores, and obviously, you know, under the radar because they can't come out publicly and, you know, say who their sources are. But with data like that, I think you can understand why Apple would be hesitant to roll back the design in any way, also to admit that there were any issues with the design. And I fully understand that this is not an endorsement that all of the people who are buying the new version of the MacBook Pro, the 2016 and the 2017 model, like the keyboard design or feel that it doesn't have any issues, or feel that there's not a problem with the new models having a lack of various port options and SD cards. There's a lot of reasons why people, even buying the new models, might not be fully happy with all of the design decisions and decisions that Apple made. But point is, they're still buying them because that's the machine that they want. It has the processors. It has the power that they want. They see something in it that brings that value to the table. And, you know, the point is, if Apple isn't selling those older models in droves, or at least in a reasonable percentage of all of the machines being sold, then they really don't have an incentive to go back to that old design, right? If people aren't speaking with their buying decisions, then, you know, Apple's going to stick with what they think is the future of the MacBook Pro, and obviously that seems to be this new keyboard design. To me, Apple has made a clear statement by removing the 2015 option that they see this design as the future of the MacBook Pro, and that they intend to continue to enhance and improve upon this design and not roll back to the old one. And I fully understand that this will obviously upset some people in our community. It upsets some customers. But at this point, that does seem to be a small minority of users. And so my question stands, is the keyboard alone enough to make you not buy a new MacBook Pro and to look at a different option, to look elsewhere? I'd like to hear from some members of our community. Is that this big a deal? How many people really feel this way? Right now, the evidence seems to show that there's not a lot of people that feel that way, but I'd like to hear from our community. So shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And I'll just close this segment out by saying, look, you know, Apple has never been much for admitting when they're wrong, so I don't think they're going to do that on this. And they're also not a kind of company that tends to look backwards or move backwards once they've made a decision. They're going to move forward. They're going to stick with it. They're going to continue to improve the design. They're probably address some of the customer complaints and issues with the current design if they can. And that's going to be kind of the end of it moving forward. But that's kind of all of the updates with the new MacBook Pros. We're going to be getting a lot more information and details again as real-world testing happens, as people get into these into their hands and evaluate them. Some of that has been happening already. I can tell you so far, the reviews have been very, very positive. The keyboard is definitely quieter. I've heard some tests related to that. Also, they're just screaming machines. I mean, the performance is really through the roof. So this is a really nice update to the MacBook Pro. If you'd been waiting on getting a new model, now is probably the right time to pick one up. I feel pretty confident in saying that. If I had the money and if my 2015 wasn't such a great machine already, I would definitely be picking one of these up, no doubt about it. The updates aren't going to just stop with the MacBook Pros, though, and that's some good news. Analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says that before the year is out, Apple will update all the things. Refreshes to the iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch. I think we knew those were coming. But he says, yep, we're also going to get some iMac updates. And yes, even the Mac Mini is finally going to get some love. And of course, a lot of the stuff we've heard already. We're expecting the three new iPhone models, the 6.1-inch LCD version, the two OLED models in 5.8-inch and 6.8-inch designs. We'll talk about those a little bit more later. Non-home button iPads we've been hearing about with Face ID technology and true depth camera systems coming in 11-inch and 12.9-inch models. He says 11-inch. I don't know if that means it's going to be an update from the 10.5-inch. I think it refers to the display size. I think Apple is going to increase the display, reduce the bezels, and that's how you end up with an 11-inch iPad Pro, but still in the 10.5-inch form factor. And then, of course, processor updates to the MacBook line to kind of match along with what we got with the MacBook Pro line. When that's going to happen, we don't really know, but we are expecting those updates to happen sometime this year. And then there's kind of the newer stuff that he was talking about. There's been these rumors about a new low-priced notebook offering, whether that's going to be a MacBook Air or a MacBook model. That's sort of up to debate. It seems like Ming-Chi Kuo is leaning toward a new lower-cost 12-inch MacBook model that would basically replace the MacBook Air. And to me, that makes the most sense, that it's going to be thin and light like the MacBook Air, but fall into the MacBook lineup. It kind of simplifies the lineup a little bit. You just have MacBooks and MacBook Pros, and I think that's the right way for Apple to go moving forward. Those two lines have been sort of merging anyway, and I fully expect to see, you know, that be the new low-priced offering from Apple this year. iMacs, we're expecting a processor refresh and what Ming-Chi Kuo called a, quote, significant display performance upgrade. He didn't go into details on what that meant, but there have been a lot of people speculating and talking about the fact that Apple might bring their ProMotion technology that they added to the iPads over to their iMac displays. So the 120 hertz refresh rates, super fast refresh rates, that would basically double the refresh rate of the current iMac models, and that would be a significant display performance upgrade. So I expect that that is what we'll see with the iMac displays. And then we are expecting some new Apple Watches, two new models with bigger displays, 39.9 millimeter and 45.2 millimeter. Those are possibly going to come with reduced bezels, so that would actually keep the physical sizes of the Apple Watch models the same at 38 millimeters and 42 millimeters. We're also expecting to get some heart rate detection updates and feature enhancements in those new Apple Watch models. And then finally, the Mac Mini, surprisingly the biggest surprise of the rumors for a lot of us. A lot of us were getting kind of uncertain that Apple was going to give the Mini any love. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of details here. Processor updates are going to happen. That's, of course, to be expected, especially given the age of the Mac Mini. The thing hasn't been updated since 2014. But what about ports? USB-C, Thunderbolt 3 ports? I think probably likely, at least a couple of them. Apple could stick, I guess, with Thunderbolt 2 to kind of keep the pricing down. SSD options, more Fusion options. That's something I think a lot of us would really like to see come back to the Mac Mini. Right now, we do have a few Fusion Drive options, but still those 5400 RPM slow hard drives that are really keeping the performance down on the Mac Mini. If you have a Mac Mini, we talked about this on the MacCast, the absolute best update you can do to it is throw an SSD in that thing. It'll make it a brand new machine. So Apple needs to have that be, I think, the default option. I think we're done pretty much with spinning drives. Fusion is an okay compromise, but I really think the future needs to be full SSD on all models across the board. Whether Apple will do that this time around with the Mac Mini, I think is doubtful, but at least hopefully we'll have some of those options. And then the big question, are we going to get a redesigned case or a redesigned form factor? I think the Mac Mini is way overdue. I also think they can make it a lot smaller and a lot cooler, and I'd like to see them do that. So let's hope that that happens. But at least the good news is we're likely going to get a Mac Mini update this year. So what do you think about all this? You know, that's everything being updated all in the last half of the year. I think it could be very expensive for a lot of us Mac fans, myself included, but we'll have to see. Not surprisingly, having new models out there in the marketplace might help sell more machines. We got new estimates from Gartner this week claiming that Apple sold 4.4 million Macs in the three-month period ending in June, giving them about a 7.1% share of the worldwide PC market, so Apple moving up. It was also a 3% increase in Mac shipments over the same period a year ago, so Mac shipments up year over year, according to this report. The report also notes that the PC market in general saw an uptick, though Apple's increases seem to have outpaced their competitors. The general increase, they say, came mainly, though, from the business market, who has been upgrading their machines, and that general sales to non-business users, just to general consumers, seem to continue to decline as more and more users tend to rely on smartphones and tablets as alternatives for their daily computing needs. And that just goes to prove what we talked about, I think, a couple episodes back, that maybe we don't need to have Mac updates as frequently anymore for a couple of reasons. One, we all know that older Mac models last a lot longer. They run very, very well, continue to be good performers for 3, 4, 5 years for a lot of us. And also just the buying habits of consumers are generally slowing down. We're not upgrading as frequently because we have these other options for our computing needs. So I think it's, you know, I do think it's important to keep up with maybe the processor updates more frequently, but I think we can go longer and longer between major revisions and major changes to designs, and I fully expect Apple to do that moving forward. And I think that is, again, a symptom of numbers like this, where just the general sales uptick on the PC market is slowing down. And so it makes logical sense for upgrades to slow down along with that. But that's kind of the latest with all of the updates that we're hearing about. Let's talk about those iPhones for a little bit. We do know that we've had very strong rumors about the three display sizes. Well, this week, images appeared from Ben Gaskin, who has been a reliable leaker of iPhone information in the past. He posted some images reportedly showing the three displays, display components, and all three of them show thinner, but not quite as thin on the LCD model, bezels. So the thin bezel designs, the 5.8 inch model, of course, looks almost identical, if not identical, to the current 5.8 inch display that is on the iPhone X. The 6.5 inch model for the larger rumored iPhone X Plus that we'll be getting this year is a bigger version of that display. And then you have, most surprisingly, that 6.1 inch LCD display. That one has the thin bezels and, of course, the notch for the true depth camera system. And they are almost as thin as the ones on the OLED display, which is not an easy feat to achieve with LCD panels. According to DigiTimes, they say that Apple has actually placed orders with LG for displays, for OLED displays and LCD displays. Apple has reportedly requested 3 to 4 million OLED panels and about 20 million LCD displays. So it looks like LG is going to be providing some, but not all of the OLED panels for Apple's iPhones this year, and likely all of the 6.1 inch LCD displays. So 20 million units there. OLED orders, you know, might seem a little bit low from LG, but remember that Samsung is Apple's main supplier for those panels. So the thought is that LG may be supplying the bulk of the 6.5 inch plus display, and then Samsung is reportedly going to get the rest of the models. One other thing potentially related to future iPhones, Samsung announced that it completed functional testing and validation of the industry's first 10 nanometer class 8 gigabit LPDDR5 5 RAM. This new RAM is reportedly 1.5 times faster than the LPDDR4X RAM that is currently in the iPhone X, and has some new features, including new sleep mode and other energy-saving options that could reduce power consumption of the RAM up to 20%. So it's expected that at some point this new RAM will show up in future iPhones, not this year's models, but potentially next year's models, though the timeline is unclear. But that's kind of the latest on what's happening in the iPhone space. And then finally in the news for this week, one quick little story. Apple is reportedly killing their print products in iPhotos. We've reached that day. People are not ordering as many print products anymore, and Apple is getting out of that side of the photo business. Apple has started notifying customers that they will have until September 30th, 2018 to purchase printable items using the built-in projects feature inside Photos. Those messages started showing up as a pop-up for users with macOS 10.13.6. That started happening last week. As an alternative, Apple is recommending that you download third-party apps from the App Store, which support Photos Projects extension. So third-party apps and suppliers still can have that stuff built into Photos using the extensions feature, but it's not going to be supported by Apple after September 30th. And I expect that they will likely pull the Projects section out of Photos at that point. So if you're a fan of that, just be prepared for that. Don't get caught off guard. It's happening come September 30th, 2018. And I do know a lot of people who really like, you know, things like being able to get the calendars made or have photo books made and stuff like that. It was a really nice option for a really long time. But now that so many people have iPhones and iPads and other devices, I think a lot of that stuff is moving digitally to our devices, and fewer people are just ordering that stuff. So it's time for that to go away. But with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Jamf Now. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. It's easy to track your own Mac, iPad, or iPhone, but what about other Apple devices at work? As a business grows, your digital inventory grows, and it makes it exponentially harder to manage all of those Apple devices. This is especially true if you have employees in remote locations, and that's where Jamf Now can help. You can check your digital inventory, distribute Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy apps, protect your company data, and even lock or wipe a device as needed from anywhere using Jamf Now. Jamf Now manages devices so you can focus on your business instead, and no IT experience is needed. Look, if you run any kind of operation where you're dealing with multiple devices, a multi-device management solution is a must, so you really should take a moment and check out Jamf Now. And they make it super easy to get started because you can manage up to 3 devices for free. So go in there, there's no risk. You can try it out completely free. And it's specifically designed for teams and small businesses, and they make it super easy to get going. So MacCast listeners, you can start securing your business today by setting up your first 3 devices for free, and that's forever. You could add more for just $2 a month per device. And you create your account by simply going to jamf.com/MacCast and signing up. It really is that easy. That's jamf.com/MacCast, MacCast. And a huge, huge thank you to Jamf Now for their support of the show. All right, let's get into some more of the subscription app feedback. We've been covering this on the last few episodes of the MacCast, and it's been a great topic on our community. I'm hearing great opinions and comments from all of you. This week, Diego brought up an interesting follow-up that we hadn't heard about, and he says that he feels subscription apps possibly suffer from less loyalty because subscriptions make it easier to be not attached to the product, i.e. you haven't spent maybe a large amount of money, you're only spending a few $5 a month, maybe $5, $10 a month. So, hey, it's easier to jump away when there's other options. Not having that large upfront investment in a piece of software makes it easier to switch if you find an alternative. And he gave a couple of examples. He said AI Writer versus Ulysses, Illustrator versus Sketch, Adobe Premiere versus DaVinci Resolve. So these are all apps where the first one is a pay up front, pay once model, and the latter is a subscription model. Well, I guess I flopped the ones in the case of AI Writer and Ulysses. So Ulysses versus AI Writer. Ulysses is the subscription model. AI Writer is the pay once model. And you know, I get the point of that. You know, there's some logic in that. My opinion, though, Diego, is I think it's in some ways about the, I call them more timid users when I sent the email back to Diego. I said they're kind of running for the hills when faced with the idea of an ongoing payment for the use of software. That's maybe not the fairest accusation or claim to lay against them. But I think the point that I'm trying to make is that it really comes down to, I think the subscription model separates the wheat from the chaff when it comes to software. And what I mean by that is that I think there's a lot of people who purchase an application who fall on the edge of that app being a critical piece of software that they need for daily use, for something that they really rely on. And that's not to say that the examples that you gave, Diego, aren't really great applications that people really do rely on. But, you know, software is one of those things that I think is very personal, and it has to meet the needs of the user. And there's many ways that a piece of software can meet those needs. So you can't just compare two apps that do the same core function, right? Because from a UI perspective, from a design philosophy perspective, from a workflow perspective, those two applications can work very, very differently. They're not necessarily equals. And so what I'm talking about when I say that, you know, the more timid users are the people that are kind of the edge cases, it's somebody that hears about an application. They hear that it's really good. Maybe they read a review. Maybe it's the best, considered the best in class for that application by a lot of people in the community. And they go, well, that's just the thing I'm going to buy then. You know, if they say that's the best, that's the thing I'm going to get. And they get in there and they start using it, and they maybe start to realize, well, this is great. It's good, but I don't use every feature. It's kind of does more things than I want. It's not, it's not meeting all my needs in all the right places. Or maybe it's just the kind of piece of software where it's like they don't use it as frequently as maybe they thought they were going to, or maybe just didn't need to use it. And so when they're faced with, now I have to pay for this every month and it's ongoing, and if I stop paying, I don't get to use this anymore, I think, yes, at that point, it's very natural to start to go to look for alternatives, for something that better meets those needs. And these are the same people who also, I think, might not upgrade a paid for app every cycle because, again, they don't rely on all the features. Maybe the new stuff that was put in there doesn't add enough value for them. And that also does become sometimes another reason why people switch away from even, you know, pay one time apps or don't upgrade pay one time apps. So I don't think a lot of this stuff is all that different or changed by the fact that there's subscription models now. I think this is also, you know, moving to a subscription model for these same reasons. I think that's another reason why some developers are choosing to adopt the subscription model. They would rather have fewer but more loyal customers who are willing to pay on a regular basis to support the product than have more customers with a lot on this kind of edge case where they maybe don't upgrade every time, and it's harder to sell them on the product because they're just not using all the functionality, or it's not the perfect fit for them. And I have a feeling that developers would agree with you. It's like, at that point, it's better if those customers go find an alternative, a piece of software that better meets its needs. And of course, I shared a lot of these opinions with Diego over email, And he still didn't feel the same about it and pointed out that the examples that he gave were heavily used pieces of software. And I totally agree with that. I mentioned that earlier. You know, every one of those pay up front alternatives that he mentioned are excellent pieces of software. And a lot of them aren't cheap. DaVinci Resolve is not a cheap piece of software. It is a high level pro piece of software, and it's used by a lot of people over Adobe Premiere. But I'm just arguing that I don't think it's the subscription model necessarily when you're at that level and it is that critical of a piece of software to your organization. I don't think it's just the subscription model or pricing that makes you move away or move to an alternative. I think it's likely the thing that maybe pushes you over the edge to switch, but I don't think it's the only reason. And that was my only point. And so my point is, again, I think at first moving to a subscription model for many developers will cause a certain percentage of customer loss. But I'm going to argue that that's actually a good thing, both for the customer and for the developer. Customers are basically forced to look at a piece of software, evaluate its value to them, and in some cases, they'll realize that that software that someone told them about or told them that it was the thing to get or that it was the de facto standard isn't something that they really require or need, and they're going to find a better alternative, and they're going to be happier for it. And I think that's a great thing. I think developers ultimately wind up with more dedicated and loyal customers who do find total value in the product that the developer is creating. And the developer also gains more sustained and consistent revenue stream, which helps them continue to improve and work on their product. So I think that's great all the way around. I think it's also great for the many, many great alternative apps out there, to the big guys like Adobe and Microsoft. They have an opportunity to gain a bunch of new customers who will grow to love and use their software and be dedicated to those products as well, regardless of what subscription model, what pricing model they use, whether it be subscription or one time with upgrades. And so the final point, after going back with Diego, that he came up with was that he did not feel that there was, quote, a long-term future for simple apps that embrace subscriptions. And he felt they were, quote, too exposed to competitors who offer non-subscription options. So he's talking about some of the more lightweight applications that you maybe pay a little bit less for. So we're talking about, he didn't say this, but in my mind, I'm thinking these are apps that are in the maybe $5, $10, $15, $20 range, right? You buy the app one time, it's $20. It's not too expensive. It's something you're going to use. It maybe is kind of a one shot. It does one thing really, really well. It's highly specialized. And so his point is like, who's going to want to pay a subscription for that? It's much easier just to buy it the one time. And, he thinks that customers will choose the non-subscription option and doesn't see it going the other way. Like when faced with a subscription, if a developer took one of those apps, tried to turn it into a subscription app, that immediately most of the customers would just look for an alternative. And he doesn't see that happening the other way, where if you have an app like that you pay one time, one price up front, and then there's an alternative that is a subscription version, that customers won't necessarily want to move over to that subscription version. And I feel this has more to do with the app and the price of the subscription. And the point is, the same issue comes into place as we were talking about earlier. It's all to do with the value that you may or may not get out of that piece of software and whether you feel the price that you're paying warrants that value. And this may be sounding like it's obvious, but I think a lot of people miss this. But this is how we buy everything, right? You decide, do the features, do the quality, does the quality, does the functionality, does the joy, whatever the factors are, in aggregate, do these things bring the value to me that I feel warrants whatever price I'm paying? So if you have an app that you love and are dependent upon and you find value in it and the price is right, subscription or not, you're going to buy it. For me, if an app is $10 to $20 a year on subscription and I get value out of that, that's the same as me buying the app for, say, $30 up front the first time and then paying $15, $20 again when a paid upgrade comes out in a year. It's an app that I'm going to continually support, buy the upgrades, and whether I'm paying a yearly subscription fee that is reasonable or a one-time and upgrade price that I consider reasonable for the value that I'm getting out of it, I'm going to do it either way. And that was kind of my main point. You know, I'm not here advocating that everything should adopt a subscription model. I think far from it. I don't think subscription works for every application. I also am, though, starting to realize that subscriptions aren't all that bad. And that was my main point when I brought this whole conversation up, was when subscriptions were first happening, I thought it was the death of software. I thought it was the worst thing that could possibly happen to the software industry. And I am just changing my opinion on that. I think there's a place for both. And I think we are going to see more and more applications moving to subscription. You know, I think it's obvious if a developer overcharges for the subscription, then people are going to look for alternatives. Absolutely. But the same is true for an overpriced one-time payment app, right? They have to find the right price point to that value. So, you know, that was kind of my thoughts on that part of it. Of course, Diego wasn't the only person that I heard from. I also heard from listener Paul this week. He had some thoughts on a number of items. I'm just going to share with you some comments he made on this subscription conversation. So here's what Paul had to say about that.
Hi, Adam. It's Paul Adkins here from the UK. Just picking up on a couple of things that have been mentioned in the past show or past couple of shows. One was the discussion about software on subscription and this subscription model, which I'm in two minds about this. I think that for certain things, if the subscription is affordable, then it might be worthwhile. But in a lot of cases, I don't think it is. And two of the pieces of software that were mentioned, one of which was Text Expander, in the last program, and the guy was saying that you know, he didn't feel that it was fair to have to pay all of the money for group usage when he was using it by himself. Well, I have an oldish version of Text Expander, and Smile have sent me many emails saying, would I like to upgrade for this, you know, extra special price, which is still far more than I want to pay, because what the version I've got at the moment works absolutely fine. It does everything I want it to do. So until the Mac OS reaches a point where my version of Text Expander won't run anymore, then I'm not going to change it, and certainly wouldn't consider a subscription for that particular piece of software, because personally I don't use it enough. The same is true of PDF Pen Pro. I use it, but I don't use it that often, and the version I'm using is quite an old one. I think it's 5.something or other, but it works fine. It works absolutely fine. So the idea of you know, updating it is, to me, pointless. So that's my personal opinion. But I will continue listening to your show, and I'm very interested in your views and all the things you have to say. So that's great. So I look forward to the next one. So thank you very much. Cheers, then.
Hey, cheers, Paul. Yeah, actually, thank you for listening, and thank you for your comments and your opinions. Again, all I can say is I totally agree. You say the software needs to be affordable and make sense, and I think that's exactly what we're talking about here. And I think that's regardless of the model that they choose to use. I just think saying the word affordable, you know, the software needs to be affordable, that could be a little bit too simplistic. I think I like the word value a little bit more. It needs to have value. You need to feel like the cost justifies the utility and the value that you're getting back from the software. And on your final comment about not updating older versions of software, like sticking with an older version, that's an interesting one too. I mean, we already covered this a little bit in the past shows, but I think it's worth bringing up again. It's a big problem for developers when customers don't want to upgrade or hold on to an old version. And, you know, that's part of the reason why some of them are considering subscriptions. It does address and somewhat solve that issue because you have a guaranteed recurring revenue source. Now, of course, a lot of customers don't like that. They don't like feeling like they're being forced to upgrade something. They also don't like sometimes that they're the feeling that maybe they're being forced into buying or adopting features that they don't like. And, you know, there are, again, customers who don't like updating their older software. You know, they feel like it saves them money, especially if the upgrade doesn't have new features that they feel they need. They're perfectly happy to stick with those older versions. And that's great until you get a developer who doesn't have enough people buying their new stuff and they have to stop making the software altogether, and then support and everything goes away. So there's a potential downside to people who don't upgrade, because developers do lose reoccurring and sustaining revenue. You know, the past solution was paid upgrades, but often those don't work because customers, again, choose to opt out of those upgrades and they just stick with an old version. As an example, to this day, I know people who are still running Adobe Photoshop CS5 because it, quote, works just fine for them, and they don't need the new features that are in Adobe. And that's great, again, until the developer can no longer sustain his business. So I don't know that subscriptions are perfect. I know they're not perfect for every scenario. I know they're not perfect for every customer. My ultimate point in all of this is I think it's great that we're getting to the point where subscription models are getting more mature. Developers are getting more aware of what works and what doesn't work. And they're finding a way to make it work for their business. And that was ultimately my biggest concern when we started having the app stores and race to the bottom pricing and some of the restrictions that were put on that with the inability to do paid for upgrades. And a lot of this, there were a lot of questions about how our developers are going to solve this. How are developers going to solve these problems? How are they going to create sustaining revenue models? You know, where is all this going? And I'm just getting to the point where I think there are a lot of cases where subscriptions make sense. And if it helps developers and continues to allow us to get great software and a great variety of software in our environments, both on iOS and macOS, I think I'm okay with that. I'm coming to the resolution that it's not all bad. And it still feels like there's a lot of folks in the community that feel like subscription models are you know, straight out of the mind of the devil or something like that, and that they're purely evil. And I just don't feel that they are anymore. But I love all of the dissenting opinions. I love people who disagree with me. So please, if you do, write in, email, disagree with me. You know, these are just my opinions, and I'm just sharing them, and you don't have to agree with them whatsoever. If you do, I'd love to hear from you too. If you think I'm on board and on point, again, I'm more in the middle. I'm not all for subscription models. I'm just not all against them anymore like I was in the past. So thank you all for these great conversations. I really appreciate every email and response that comes in, and I do read them all. And even if you don't get covered on the show, I do try to respond to you in email. So thanks for that, and keep those coming. Okay. Last thing that I want to talk to you about today, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it's kind of vacation time for a lot of us, and for a lot of people that means being away from Wi-Fi maybe for longer periods and relying on our cellular devices, on our iPhones, our cellular iPads, maybe a Wi-Fi hotspot, something like that. Unfortunately, when you're doing that, that also means that you might be running up against your cellular data limits, you might be paying overage costs or fees that you don't want to necessarily be paying. And I thought, well, that means it's probably helpful for us to have a little conversation and some tips on controlling and better monitoring our cellular data usage. Part of me bringing this up actually comes from an email I received from listener Toby. His wife hit her data cap while on vacation recently, and in the process of trying to determine, you know, why did we hit the cap and how can we maybe restrict some of this data that's going out and what's going on here, Toby noticed that large amounts of data were being consumed and used up, cellular data, even when the device wasn't in active use. And so that got him doing a little bit of head scratching. It's like, well, I know stuff happens in the background. You know, he's not naive to that, but why is there so much? Like, what is happening behind the scenes? And so he asks, you know, what's happening behind the scenes? Can you kind of explain that with the data usage? And how can you reduce or restrict or limit this usage beyond the obvious method of just turning cellular data off altogether, which basically cripples the entire device, right? You need some cellular data for certain things to work. So how can I go in and manage and control this and figure you know, better deal with it? So kind of two questions here. I'll start with the first one, which is, what's all this background data? What is happening on your device when you're not even, you know, actively looking at it, when it's just sitting there on the table, you know, at the campsite, and suddenly it's eating up all your data? Well, quite frankly, a lot. Our devices are constantly working even when we're not actively interacting with them. So they can be doing app updates, automatic downloads, background app refreshing, fetching emails, doing iCloud syncing, you know, syncing your calendars, your contacts, all that stuff, syncing your iCloud photo library. Who knows what's going on? It's going to vary and depend upon all of the settings that you have set up and what you've allowed to operate over cellular data and what's being blocked and stuff like that. By default, though, I think part of the problem is a lot of this stuff is just turned on. Like, the floodgates are open, and I think a lot of us don't realize it until we are actually in a situation where we are relying more heavily on cellular data. So let's talk about maybe some of the ways to help identify and deal with that background data usage. You know, one quick and easy way, and I did this while I was on vacation, was to reduce a lot of the background data usage temporarily, is to enable low power mode on your device. And a secondary benefit of this, of course, is you're going to reduce your battery usage. So this is also helpful when you're not going to be near an outlet or a charging location for a while. If you can't get to a charging point, just simply put your device into low power mode and run it in that mode all the time, because the core functionality all continues to work just fine. What it does is it shuts down some of the background stuff and maybe some of the stuff you don't necessarily need all the time, especially when you're relying on cellular data. So you'll find the setting in settings, battery. You can also add it to your control center as an item. I actually added it to my control center, and it was really handy because I could just, you know, swipe down on my iPhone 10, access control center, and quickly toggle it on or off as needed. To do that, you'd go into settings, control center, and then click on the or tap on the customize control option, and then you can select and add the low power mode button to your control center. It looks like a little battery. And so what does low power mode do? It actually reduces email fetching. It disables Hey Siri from operating. It goes into, sorry, there goes my phone. It goes and turns off background app refreshing. Automatic downloads cease. It turns off some of the visual effects. Auto lock defaults to 30 seconds, so it's going to go into auto lock more quickly to conserve battery power. And iCloud photo library is temporarily paused, so you're not going to be syncing your big, you know, iCloud photo library. And when you enable it, the battery icon on your device turns to a yellow color versus the red or green that you normally would see, and that's what indicates that the feature is enabled. So as you can see, it immediately kind of shuts down a lot of background processes that could potentially be using your cellular data. Now, it's not going to do everything, and some of the other methods I'm going to share with you are going to be a little bit more effective, but this one's really quick and easy, so I wanted to point that one out first because it may be not It might not be as obvious because you're thinking it's more about battery power, but it's also about restricting your data usage and your data access a little bit. So another thing that you can do, of course, is turn off what is called background app refresh. And a lot of people don't realize that apps have the ability to update data in the background. So just when they're running not as the main application, but just running in the background, or even as your iPhone is sitting idle, or iPad is sitting idle, it can be updating data to the application. So if it's getting data from the cloud, from the internet, that data can be being pulled down. So podcast apps will do this. RSS reader apps will do this. Actually, a lot of apps do this. Probably some apps that you wouldn't even think would need to do it. So one thing you can do is turn off background app refreshing when you're on cellular data. So if you go into settings, general, background app refresh, you can tap background app refresh at the top and just make sure that it is set to Wi-Fi only and not Wi-Fi and cellular. So that ensures that the feature only works when you're on a Wi-Fi network and it's not going to use up your cellular data. Also on that main background app refresh screen in settings, you can individually toggle which apps are allowed to refresh their data in the background. And that turns off background app refresh completely for that application. So it's kind of separate from, you know, just disabling it from cellular. If you toggle it off, that app is not going to update until you reopen the app again. And the whole point behind background app refreshing is a faster, more seamless experience. So say, for example, your calendar app, it can be updating if someone makes a change to the calendar in the cloud and you're on a shared calendar, you're going to open up that application and that change will already be there versus opening up the app and having to wait a few seconds while it reconnects to the internet and downloads that information. But if you're on cellular data, you might want to turn that off so that it's not doing that stuff in the background. Another thing you can do is you can actually see which apps are using cellular data and how much, and you can control those apps. These are in the settings, under settings in cellular. So if you go into settings cellular on your device, down toward the bottom, you'll see a section called cellular data, and that lists all of the apps that are allowed to use cellular data, and it has little toggles for turning on and off the access for those apps. To be able to operate using cellular data. And you can also view those apps, their actual data usage for both the current billing period and the last billing period of your cell phone bill. Unfortunately, these are listed alphabetically and not by app data usage, and you can't actually sort them that way. That would be a nice feature, maybe a thing to put into feedback at the app or apple.com/feedback. But anyway, under the name of each one of the apps, it will list, if it's used any data for that period, it will list the amount of data that it's used. So you can kind of scroll through that list and identify maybe the application when you're on cellular that's really chewing up and eating through your data. And again, you can toggle off any apps you don't want to be able to use data over cellular, or any apps that might be currently heavily using cellular data. So you can just toggle those off while you're on vacation, and then when you get back home, just remember to go in and toggle them back on if you want those features to still work. And if you want to see which system applications are using data, just scroll down toward the bottom of that list, that application list, and you'll see one called System Services. If you tap on that, it will show you all of the system stuff that's using cellular data. Now, unfortunately, with these, you can't toggle those on and off individually. You'll have to go in and control that stuff through other settings. But at least you can see how much data those things are using. And for me, you know, no surprise, my cellular data hotspot was the big one. It used like 2.3 gigabytes in the current billing period. And that was because I was on vacation and I was letting people use my Wi-Fi hotspot. So obviously a lot of data got used up. So no surprise there, but that's another place you can check to kind of control and configure things and also see that data usage. Another helpful thing you can do to limit your cellular data usage is turn off automatic app updates in the iTunes and App Store. So if you go into, again, settings under the iTunes and App Store option, there is a toggle for use cellular data, and you can just simply toggle that off, and that way those updates won't happen automatically using your cellular data. Some other things that you can look at that aren't not really specifically related to background data usage, but do affect your cellular data usage. Wi-Fi Assist, which is a feature that kicks in when you have a weak Wi-Fi signal. Basically, it recognizes, oh, you have weak Wi-Fi. I'm just going to switch you over to cellular so you have a better connection. You'll find this in settings under cellular. And you'll have to scroll all the way to the bottom past that long list of applications and all those toggles. And then you'll see the Wi-Fi assist toggle. If that is turned on, that means it will switch over to cellular to use cellular data if you have a weak Wi-Fi signal. You may want to toggle that off to make sure that you always stay on Wi-Fi, even when Wi-Fi may not be the best signal around. Another just general bit of advice, this may seem obvious, but you know, download your media before you go on your trip. Don't stream media when you're on your trip. And you can actually control this for music in settings music. There's a toggle in there. You can tap on cellular data and you can toggle off the streaming option, which means it won't stream over cellular data, but you will be able to stream music over Wi-Fi still. There's also a setting in there to disable high quality streaming. So if you turn that off, you're going to get lower bitrate audio files, but that's going to save you on your data usage. And finally, in there, there's also a way to disable downloads over cellular. So you're not able to download music over the cellular network and again, potentially use up a lot of your cellular data. And there's also a similar setting for cellular data in the settings for podcasts. So if you go into the settings under podcasts, you'll see a cellular data toggle in there as well. So there you go. That's a number of things that you can do to help better monitor and manage your cellular data usage. And I hope, Toby, that you find that information useful in the future. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I have one quick little housekeeping thing for you. If you are a Patreon supporter and you are supporting at the $5 classic level or the $10 pro level, your Patreon supporter cards are now in. I ordered those a while back and they are here. They look amazing. These are metal black supporter cards that I'm going to be sending to supporters who support at that level. They are laser etched, die cut, screen printed. They look amazing. They have your name and membership number on them. I can't wait to get them into your hands. Although, unfortunately, I have MacStock coming up in a couple days, so I'm not going to be able to get them shipped out this week. I'm going to be trying to start shipping them out next week, so those will be on their way to you. To that end, please make sure you go into your Patreon account under your memberships. Check the MacCast membership and make sure that your address is up to date, that I have your current shipping address, because I will be printing those labels starting next week. Also, if you are going to physically be at MacStock and you are a supporter at that level, a Patreon supporter, get me an email by the end of day Wednesday. Let me know and I can hand deliver your card to you in person at MacStock. I will be bringing those for anybody who wants me to. So just let me know about that. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then one other thing, if you're planning on changing your pledge level, your pledge amount, or your tier in Patreon to qualify for the Classic or Pro level, just be aware, I discovered that those two actions, the pledge amount and the reward tier, are two separate things. So make sure you go in and change your reward tier up to the $5 Classic or the $10 Pro level. That will automatically change the pledge amount. If you just go in and change the pledge amount on your current subscription, it keeps you, or your current tier, it keeps you at whatever tier you're at. It just changes the pledge amount. So be aware of that. Those are two separate things. And then finally, if you want to become a supporter of the MacCast through Patreon, I really appreciate everyone who supports the show directly. It means a lot to me and my family. It enables me to continue to do the podcast. It helps cover a lot of the day-to-day production costs and hosting bills and just the general business bills that I have. It means a huge amount to me. And so if you'd like to become a supporter, it's easy to do. You can get all the details and information by going to patreon.com/MacCast. That's patreon.com/MacCast. And you'll get all the details there. So thanks for that. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.